North Korea replaced long-range missiles with parade floats on Sunday as it celebrated the 70th anniversary of the country's founding. That move underlined Kim Jong-un's stated aim to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Despite stalled talks, South Korean officials say Kim wants to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula in Trump's first term. Kim and South Korean President Moon Jae-in will meet later this month to discuss practical measures towards that goal.
The U.S. Open women's final ended in controversy, tears, and now a $17,000 fine for Serena Williams. Williams was openly seething during the match after Ramos accused her of receiving help from her coach in the stands, later smashing her racket on the court, and finally calling Ramos a thief for docking her a point penalty.
There's a gold rush going on in emerging market hotspots around the world, pushing gold prices within those troubled economies to record highs. It's an economic washout. When this happens, people will cash in anything they can in favor of something that holds value, like gold or the U.S. dollar. Some countries are buying the precious metal to strengthen their local currency.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's September the 10th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Here we are with another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day, another business week getting underway. Thank you for being here with us this morning. We appreciate you tuning in, and we've put together a really good broadcast for you today. Monday, always our CEO spotlight, and we're happy to have CEO of Spring CM with us today. Dan Daldegan is here. We're going to be talking about their merger with DocuSign coming up momentarily. Also, a little bit later in the program, Mark Hamrick will be here from Bankrate.com. We're going to talk about a Bankrate survey of economists. Where most of those economists now have some signs of concern about the economy. That's coming up at about 5:40 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with some overnight intel from around the world. First, in the U.S., futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street a little bit later on this morning. Dow futures are up about 71 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are up anywhere from a third to a quarter, third to a half a percent. Around the globe, markets in Europe generally are higher this morning. The FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC are up about a quarter each. In Asia, markets are generally lower. The Hang Seng off more than a percent and a third, down 360 points. The Nikkei going to end the day in positive territory. Markets elsewhere in Europe also lower. Oil is trading this morning at $68.14 a barrel. A couple of headlines before we begin this morning. First, to CBS, shortly after resigning as CEO of CBS, Les Moonves denied sexual misconduct allegations. A three-paragraph statement from Moonves says untrue allegations from decades ago being made against him and are not consistent with who he is. Moonves says it was a privilege to lead CBS during what he called the transformation, renaissance transformation of that media company. CBS and Moonves parting ways. After those allegations, no word on what the exit deal might include, but in a statement, Moonves says he'll donate $20 million to one or more organizations that support the Me Too movement. This morning, President Trump agrees with Apple that potential tariffs on Chinese imports could make its gadgets more expensive, but he says the tech company can fix the problem by moving production to the United States. In a tweet, Mr. Trump implored the company to shift production from China. The Trump administration has imposed tariffs of $50 billion on imports from China as it's moving to add 25% duties on another $200 billion in goods. Ford says it will not be moving production of a hatchback vehicle to the United States from China, despite President Trump's claims that taxes on Chinese imports mean the Focus Active can be built in America. Citing Trump's new tariffs, Ford says it's dropping plans to ship the Focus Active from China to America. But in a statement, Ford says it would be profitable to build the Ford Active in the United States, given the forecast sales of below $50,000 for now, though. Ford simply just won't sell those vehicles here in the United States. Let's begin front and center this morning with our CEO spotlight. Dan Daldegan is here this morning, the CEO of Spring CM. Dan, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
Congratulations. Earlier in the month of August, a nice little deal between DocuSign and Spring CM. Tell us about what's happening these days at your company.
Yes, well, we're tremendously excited. Thank you, by the way, for the congrats. We've been getting a lot of that. And it's gratifying not just for the obvious economic impact it has for our employees, but the great fit that it represents, because we've actually been partners with DocuSign for several years, where we've been reselling DocuSign's e-signature platform integrated with what we call contract management. Mm-hmm. So everybody in among my friends in the industry, including my almost 12 years at Salesforce and sales leadership, my friends there who are partners of both organizations, congratulate us. And everybody, too, without exception, just says, oh, yeah, this obviously fits. Like putting on a coat off the rack at Nordstrom, and it fits with no alterations.
It's a $220 million deal. I know some of the details are, still being worked out. But what does this mean for the two companies? How will they continue to operate? What will your role be?
My role will be, much as it has been, is leading and inspiring our team to go capture an even bigger portion of the market of what we now call system of agreement. So that's a declaration of a new category, but it's really an expansion on what the marketplace has known as contract lifecycle management. And if you think of a world that both DocuSign and we are very familiar with, which is the Salesforce ecosystem, customers using Sales Cloud from mm-hmm. Salesforce, there's a trend that started about 5 years ago where there's become the tsunami of interest now in automating in the sales funnel pretty much that last frontier that had been unautomated. We automated customer service and marketing and sales forecasting and contact management, opportunity management, and then configuring and pricing and quoting. Salesforce bought a company called Steelbrick that does that, which was a very close partner of ours and DocuSign's. And what got a lot of attention the last few years is automating contract management, that part of the sales cycle that salespeople sometimes feel like they lose control of when a contract is in negotiation between buyer, seller, attorneys, procurement. And so we provide the platform for collaborating. And so we're going to continue going deep and wide with DocuSign, as part of DocuSign, on capturing that market, which we believe is about a $30 billion total addressable market.
Give us a sense of how that's changed back in the day compared to now. Everything is digital now. Back then, it was all paper, right?
And
it was
That's right.
kind of deal. Give us a sense of what it looks like for those who aren't in this field, who aren't in this space. How does it look when people start using the system?
That's a great question. So the other noteworthy thing about DocuSign and this deal that we've struck is everybody who's approached me who does not work in my industry is generally familiar with DocuSign, because almost all of us, whether it's a real estate transaction or some other B2C or B2B2C transaction, has signed a document through DocuSign, signed a contract. It could be an employment agreement. It could be a real estate contract to buy or sell a property. And so it's almost like a consumer brand. And without fail, I keep hearing from people, oh, I love DocuSign. It simplifies my life. Mm-hmm. So that digitization, try that 10 times fast, that you described, Steve, is now not just a B2B phenomenon where the corporate applications we use are increasingly digital, but it's starting to mimic what we've come to expect in our personal computing lives, our lives as consumers. Amazon set the bar for us mm-hmm. years ago on that every business application should be as easy to use, as intuitive, and as engaging as Amazon. We're now finding that with this notion of digitizing financial transactions, the expectation now for consumers and for business users is it's going to be as easy as DocuSign.
Give us a sense of the economics of this. How much money is saved when you digitize this process from your vantage point, from a business's standpoint? Give us a sense of how big this is.
Yeah, great point. So we see the savings. The return on the investment is coming in a few different buckets of value. One is the obvious of the speed with which an organization can operate now, and deals that would otherwise stagnate or just kind of fester in a certain part of the sales funnel, which is what we think of in a sales organization, is this funnel of opportunities. It's the difference between victory and defeat sometimes. And that, for an organization, you know, a Fortune 1000 company, a global company, can have value in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year in terms of deals that they would win or win faster or increase their win rate. The other value is ecological, because we're not killing as many trees now when we're not having to print a whole stack of documents and send it to you, Steve, and say, all right, all those tabs where you're supposed to sign, and if you're like me, you're invariably going to miss one. Yeah. Then they'll send it back to me and go, hey, you forgot this one. So that is all electronic now, and that's probably one of the catalysts for all the people that come to us and say, oh, I love DocuSign, whether you're providing the documents to be signed or whether you're the signer. And then the other area of economic value that we think is less obvious, but we're going to see unfold in the next few years, is that as this industry continues to grow, we're going to find, I think, this notion of a system of agreement to be as big as customer relationship management, to be as big as CRM, because of the speed with which organizations can now operate. And it's setting a bar of expectations now where customers expect to move that fast, so they're going to be putting more and more demands on the companies that serve them.
I feel sorry for the company that made those little yellow arrows, you know, that you stuck on the, remember those where it's a sign here? That company, is it still in business, I wonder?
They're probably questioning the going forward market.
So, give us a sense of who some of your clients are and what kinds of places this works best.
Great. So we're prevalent already in our relationship with DocuSign. We together had been going and capturing big parts of the market in the commercial world. So an example would be Uber, who uses us, SpringCM and DocuSign, for Uber Eats and for Uber Healthcare, as well as traditional Uber transportation. And they use this as a mechanism to do deals with thousands, actually tens of thousands of merchants and drivers. And so that's a very high volume of very simple contracts. Another end of the spectrum, also deploying our platform, would be Accenture, who has a relatively low number but very complex transactions and contracts. And so we satisfy customers at basically any point along that spectrum. In the public sector, that's an increasingly fast-growing market for us. We do business with the government, state and local governments, as well as federal civilian agencies. And we and DocuSign together are working with the Veterans Administration, with the USDA. And if you think of an organization that is heavily reliant on documents and the workflow around those documents, that's our bread and butter. And that's one of the reasons we were so attractive to DocuSign to expand their platform.
Where do you keep all of this stuff? I guess the cloud is...
In the cloud, the proverbial
generic
cloud.
Right?
That's right.
I would imagine that that's a big focus of what you do, is making sure that all of that stuff is secure in the cloud.
Exactly. Yeah. And so earning the federal government's distinction of being secure and reliable and scalable enough to pass their very stringent litmus test, it's what's called FedRAMP. And that FedRAMP authorization is something we earned about a year and a half ago, after a journey with the government of going through extremely deep and wide testing and verification, as did DocuSign in a parallel but separate effort. Of course, our two coming together, we're both FedRAMP authorized to do business with the government. What we find is that our commercial customers, when they hear that we're FedRAMP authorized, it tends to take some of the intensity out of their need to do really deep and wide functional and technical due diligence on a reliability and scalability. We'll still meet with their chief information security officers and go through that due diligence. But that's really where we shine the most, is large enterprises, commercial or public sector, who have a really high bar set for security and reliability.
SpringCM was named to the 2018 Crain's Fast 50 list. Also one of, I believe, a half dozen local tech companies that have been acquired in a deal's worth more than $50 million. So you're sort of in a little group there of companies that are doing really well. What has positioned you to be at that point? And how much have you been involved in that?
That's a great point. So first of all, the history with SpringCM, I won't bore you with the entire timeline because the company is about 13 years old. But our founder and my dear friend and my business partner running the company, Greg Buchholz, built SpringCM with his co-founders Jeff Piper and Chris King 13 years ago, and they're still shepherding the company. My history personally with SpringCM was when I was at Salesforce for almost 12 years running enterprise sales. SpringCM was my favorite partner to bring in particular to compete against Microsoft, because SharePoint, document management, Salesforce's answer was most often SpringCM. Now, I also had an element of civic pride baked into my affinity for SpringCM, because I'm born and raised in Chicago. I'm a Southsider. We live in Lincoln Park now, in and out in St. Charles, where we raised five kids. And so when I saw the tech community in Chicago growing and gaining more prominence, and not just with great companies and companies that started with humble beginnings and became noteworthy, like SpringCM, in our humble opinion, we are one of those catalysts that helps create a self-fulfilling prophecy for other entrepreneurs, other investors, and other would-be employees of tech companies who, when I started my career a long, long time ago, I'm an old guy now, I just turned 55. And in 1985, when I graduated from Illinois and I was going to Northwestern at Kellogg for my master's, it really wasn't an option in the tech world for me to build my career with a Chicago-based company, because there were a dearth of companies like the companies I spent my career with: Oracle, Sybase, Siebel Systems, Salesforce. That's no longer true. So the founders, the entrepreneurs who are from Chicago, and we have this great pride in the fact that they're hometown guys and went off to the Bay Area to create their companies, Larry Ellison, Oracle, Mark Andreessen, Netscape, Tom Siebel, Siebel Systems. I'd like to think that the next generation of a Larry Ellison, that kid somewhere who's the next Larry, that boy or girl who's 17, 18 years old now, who is, let's say, going to Peyton Prep in Chicago and is going to U of I or U of C, is more likely now to stay in Chicago because there's a capital, there's capital available. There's a venture capital community for seed funding. There's a robust network and community of tech companies that wasn't true 30 years ago in the beginning of my career.
And that's going to be my next question. The people are part of it, but what is it about the ecosystem here that makes it so rich for that kind of investment and growth?
First of all, great universities. So it starts with talent. So if you're looking for a place to set up shop where you're going to have access to great talent graduating from really strong universities, we have an embarrassment of riches in the Midwest, in particular in the Chicago area. Now, I'm biased towards U of I, right, Northwestern, my alma mater, but with U of C, the rest of the Big Ten schools, Loyola, DePaul. DePaul's one of the few schools that's actually developed a sales leadership curriculum, which I'm actively involved in and I'm quite proud of. And so it starts with that, access to talent. But then also, I think there's a pragmatism about Chicago, and my bias here will be shining through, I'm sure, brightly. But I just believe that Chicagoans, because we tend to be more grounded, more pragmatist-oriented, what I hear from investors is that when they're talking to entrepreneurs with Bay Area companies, expectations of valuations can be less grounded. The metrics and the speed at which you can actually get to certain plateaus of growth where you measure incremental success. In Chicago, we tend to do those with a practical foundation of expectations, and we're going to build more solid companies that may not grow as fast, but what Howard Tolman, my good friend, and who is the really one of the fathers of and founders of the tech scene that we're so proud of in Chicago right now, who ran 1871, really created what it is, he would describe it similarly, that Chicago will have perhaps not the front page outcomes of IPOs and acquisitions, but we're going to have more of them, more companies that actually get to a destination compared to our brethren in the Bay Area or Boston or New York or even Austin, Texas.
Let's talk about you from your leadership style. When we get CEOs in, we like to ask them questions about what it is about their background that's brought them to this point, what they do, what their routines are, how they are successful CEOs. How would you answer some of those questions?
First of all, it's one of my favorite topics, so thanks for asking that. Leadership, to me, is the essence of the conversation, and I like the way you asked it because it's about leadership, not about management. And the fundamental difference, in my view, between the two is management is about command and control and about authority, and leadership is about inspiration. Hmm. So the leaders from whom I've learned, who inspired me, I'd put right at the top of that list, Mark Benioff, who is a dear friend of mine for over 30 years. We were together as kids at Oracle in the 80s, and his career trajectory was meteoric. He rose very fast through Salesforce. He was CMO of Salesforce at age 30, which was unheard of back then. And we all knew Mark was on a trajectory to be all world. And even that expectation was exceeded by what he's achieved in founding and building Salesforce. What I learned from Mark, as well as from leaders like Tom Siebel and Larry Ellison, is that you can build a culture that is very intense and success-based, but still empathic and focused on people, and not just your employees, which is job one, but your customers, which is the, let's say that's 1A is your employees, priority 1B is your customers. But priority 1C for Mark, and this is something he's really popularized now that wasn't in the conversation when I started my career in the 80s, is the community that you serve, serving the communities in which you operate. So Mark developed, and we have followed his lead at SpringCM, a focus on and then funding for and thousands of volunteer hours focused on serving the local communities in which we operate through philanthropy, funding 501c3 charitable organizations, rolling up our sleeves and getting involved, and not just like showing up for a fundraiser in a tuxedo and writing a check and hobnobbing with other movers and shakers. I'm talking about going to help paint a school in the inner city or fix up a playground or volunteer for time at the Lurie Children's Hospital. And so our employees get to direct their volunteer hours, which is actually paid time off that they use separate from their vacation. And we just took this right out of the playbook from Salesforce, which is most of the business model we've deployed at SpringCM. I took right out of the Salesforce playbook, so it was so wildly successful. I like to think that I co-authored it. So we've been running the same plays, including our focus on the foundation, which we developed. And we take 1% of our employees' time and dedicated to spending time as a volunteer with 501c3s.
As I was researching you and getting ready for our interview today, it seems like every article that I saw about you has mentioned your family. You have a big family, five kids. How has that impacted you or changed your trajectory as a CEO, and how does it guide you as a CEO on a daily basis?
Well, first of all, it's a daily reminder of the strong parallels between parenthood and leadership, because the lessons that we learn as parents, which we're never done learning, my kids now range in age from 15 to 25, and you're never done raising your kids. And that's something that parents who we knew when our kids were little, who had older children, would tell us, and my wife, LJ, and I would kind of look at each other and go, oh, yeah. I thought it was like when they get to be 21, you just stop worrying and they're kind of on autopilot. Well, you're always parenting your children and obsessing over them, and I revel in that because it's our life's work, literally. And so I've always, one of the things, again, that I learned from Mark and I've learned from other great leaders around me is that this whole notion of work-life balance, I think, is a misnomer. I think it's the wrong conversation to be having, is how do you balance your life and your work? And like there's the, you know, tipping scales of justice that you have to decide any minute, any day. Well, where am I spending my time now, my family or my job? We live in an age now, much like you mentioned, Steve, about digitization. Mm-hmm. That has resulted in work following us 24/7, 365. It's unavoidable. Yeah. Work is in our minds. It's in our hands in the form of our phones. It's omnipresent. So this idea that you can weave into this beautiful tapestry, the fabric of your work and your family, and leading your family and inspiring them and being actively engaged with your children, even while work is either in your hand in the form of an email on your phone or it's on your mind, balancing those two and knowing when to shut the work stuff down because you're now going to focus exclusively on family, I think it's a muscle system we have to develop.
Yeah.
And my wife has inspired me. She's focused on raising our five kids throughout my career, and she's the reason that anything I've accomplished has been enabled. Without her, none of that happens, including our family. So I'm just really lucky and blessed. I've also been around leaders who have inspired me and helped me achieve what I'd call just a pragmatic viewpoint of that. And to probably more than another thing, they taught me to learn not to take ourselves too seriously. And I think that's the best culture of any company, is when you hear it described as one where we take our mission seriously. But let's face it, in the software business, we're not curing cancer, we're not establishing peace in the Middle East or solving world hunger. We're solving a problem. It's interesting. But we have a fairly mature view of it, in that we don't take it too seriously. And we realize what customers really find enduring is when we are maniacally focused on their success and we're fun to be around, we're fun to work with, we hustle, we listen, and we deliver.
How do you transmit that information to the people that work for you, this work-life balance idea? What do you tell your workers that you've learned from, you know, how you've applied that to your own self, about how you want that to be applied in their lives? And I guess the question is, if I come to work for you, am I going to be able to have the same kind of luxury you had in that work-life balance arena?
I believe so. And I think the best way to create that setting and to establish that culture and make everybody feel it is through your actions more so than your words. So we make sure when everybody comes on board at SpringCM, and it's true of our partners and our customers too, they feel like a part of our culture. But especially for our employees, when they come on board, they'll hear these words and they may have the kind of reaction that you do, Steve, which is, okay, well, when am I going to see it in the actions? Here's an example. When we have our employees, which happens from time to time, and while sad, it's inevitable that we're going to have challenges at home. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a challenge with a child. It could be a family health issue. It could be any number of things that requires us to sit down with one of our leaders or organization, or maybe the person to whom we directly report, and say, hey, this is going on. And it takes tremendous courage for somebody to come forward and say, I'm dealing with this and I need some help. I just need somebody to talk to. And when that occurs in our company, I didn't really have to bring this to SpringCM, because Greg Buchholz, our founder, who's been my dear friend since he was my partner when I was at Salesforce, we are just like-minded about this. He's another Midwestern guy. He's an Indiana Hoosier, has lived in Chicago, has raised his daughters here with his lovely wife, Tina. And we never had to sit down and discuss this like this is important to us. It's just the way we operate innately, that we'll just say to that person, hey, not only are we listening and we're in with you, let's do something about this. We've had employees of our organization whose children have been afflicted with some diseases that sadly require us to coalesce and gather and try to raise awareness and money. And we just do that. And we've done things with our foundation where we'll get involved, roll up our sleeves, and help raise money for causes that are important to our employees and therefore they're important to us. and everybody knows when they come to me with one of those conversations, my first and exclusive focus is, this is about your family. Anything that's going on with work, screw it. It doesn't matter. It is not important. That's why we have 200 employees. You got teammates who can pick up the load to allow our employee and their family to focus on this problem that they may be having with family health, with one of their kids, with an aging or ailing parent. And when you do that, I think people start to realize, wow, okay, now I get it. Now I understand what you mean when you say, this is about our people. And the job's important, but it's not nearly as important as what's going on in the rest of our lives.
Let me ask you about the economy, how things are going, not only here in Chicago, but nationally. It's whenever we have a CEO in, we like to take that gauge. How are things going in your mind? What are the positives and negatives right now?
I take comfort when I go to a restaurant and I see a lot of people waiting in line.
Yeah.
I love when I see construction cranes.
Yeah, lots of them.
I like when my friends who are in the banking business say how busy they are. Mm. And those are all great signs of a booming economy. Clearly, we're in the throes of a bull run, maybe one of the longest in U.S. history, sustained. And now that could beg the next question, which is, oh, okay, well, for how much longer? I have no idea. I'm not an economic forecaster. I'm an engineer by background. I'm not an economist. But I'll tell you what I see, which is the most visible sign of economic strength is visible through our customers. And so the industries that we serve, high tech, business services, public sector, healthcare, we see consistent strength across those industries with our customers. And so that's encouraging. But what I also like about the economy here in Chicago is, again, there's a pragmatism to it that I don't think we see too many companies getting too far ahead of their skis on growth, whether it's hiring too early, committing to big chunks of real estate too soon. So I still like that there's an air of conservatism in the economy here and the way business leaders will scale their companies.
I wanted to ask you, too, while you're here about what everybody's thinking, and that's Amazon. We're waiting on that decision, whether or not they're going to locate their second headquarters here or someplace else. What do you think about all of that?
While I think it would be tremendous if Jeff Bezos set up shop here, I don't see it as a huge mover and determinant of the success of the Chicago business community one way or the other. And I think and I don't want to dismiss it as much ado about nothing, because I think it would be great for the city. But I look at the big organizations that have really meaningful footprint here, my own alma mater, Salesforce, Google, Microsoft. And you look at the number of companies who have planted a flag in Chicago and are going to continue to grow their presence, including us now as part of DocuSign. We've just committed to doubling, and we'll probably end up quadrupling our footprint in real estate and our employee headcount in the next couple of years. And there are so many more stories like that, like us with DocuSign, that in the aggregate have a bigger positive economic impact for Chicago than, let's say, Amazon. I think it's just a lightning rod of attention because they're such a recognizable brand and such a force in the marketplace. It would be great, but I don't think you'll find any business leaders in Chicago biting their fingernails over it.
Look into a crystal ball for me. What do you see as in the short term and the long term for Spring CM?
In the short term, it's going to be very much of the same, which we've been very grateful for, and we make sure not to get spoiled by, which is growth and success of our customers. We're going to stay maniacally focused on our 650 customers. That's job one. Clearly, right behind that, if that's job 1A, 1B is looking at the 400,000 customers of DocuSign, many of whom are small businesses and, let's say, real estate agents and others who transact digitally. If you look at probably 40,000 of those 400,000, they're in the sweet spot of mid-market and enterprise commercial organizations that represent a sweet spot for us. So there's this tremendous market opportunity for us to expand, and we're going to be very mindful of where there's the best fit. But we are in a high-growth market, and the benefit of that is that the most important business discipline to have is pursuing the right opportunities that represent the right fit, and that's a great problem to have.
Dan, it's great meeting you. All the best to everybody at Spring CM. Congratulations again on the deal, and good luck going forward.
Thank you, Steve. It's been great to join you.
Dan Del Deegan, the CEO of Spring CM. You can find out more about them online. SpringCM.com is their website. You can also follow them on Twitter at Spring CM as well.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for choosing us for our Monday edition here of The Opening Bell. Glad to have you along with us. There's a new survey out among top economists that shows some concern that leaner economic times lie ahead.
what's causing the worry. We bring in Mark Hamrick this morning. Mark is a senior economist at Bankrate.com and an analyst there. Mark, good morning. Welcome back to the opening bell.
Good morning. Always great to be with you.
The Bankrate survey has a couple of headlines. One of them on the positive side is that things look really good and that perhaps they will continue being good. But there's a little bit of concern in there as well, isn't there?
Well, sure. And I think the point about this survey is that the outlook is pretty good, I would say, over the intermediate term based on what we can possibly know and expect. But longer term, essentially, we think that the U.S. economy will sort of settle back into its better established long-term trends. And so what does that mean? It means that, for example, the 4.2% growth that we had in the second quarter was probably the anomaly. But we still do expect, broadly speaking, that the growth for the full year should be quite respectable, perhaps as robust as a 3% annualized growth. And a lot of that is the benefit of the tax cut. And so that shows up in the survey where the economists are saying that, yes, you know, we should have a good hiring over the next year, averaging about 163,000 a month. That is more than enough to absorb the growth in the workforce and the population, enough to keep the unemployment rate low. And indeed, they see the unemployment rate going down to 3.7%. But longer term, they think the risks begin to sort of be weighted to the downside for, among other reasons, rising interest rates. And as I say, the fact that the federal income tax cut was front-end loaded, meaning the benefits of it begin to recede in the coming years.
This survey gets a lot of attention because there are a number of economists on here, including some well-known economists, who kind of chime in and give their two cents. One of those that's quoted in the story is National Federation of Independent Business Chief Economist William Dunkelberg. I think people probably recognize that name. He thinks that we're at a peak in terms of where we stand with the good economy and this bull run that we've been on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I took a little bit of heat in a TV interview earlier in the week where essentially someone made an accusation that I thought was basically totally unfounded, where they said, well, Democrats are trying to talk down the economy. Well, first of all, the politics essentially has nothing to do with either how we go about creating the survey or essentially how these economists view the outlook. They're paid to be right. And so, you know, obviously they're not every thing is 100% objective in the sense of being able to totally eliminate the political world from these forecasts. But Dunkelberg is a great example of someone who, number one, has been around a long time, works for a trade group which represents the interests of small business. That's hardly a flaming liberal group. And Dunkelberg has also been a leader of a regional bank and also worked on the regional Federal Reserve Board in his part of the world. He basically lives in the Philadelphia area. So, you know, I think everybody in the survey is quite reputable, and that's why we like to include their outlooks. And then taken together, we come up with a consensus, and it turns out that Dunkelberg is basically in the consensus, and that is to say, hey, you know, things are pretty good right now, but indeed, this may be just about as good as it gets for the U.S. economy.
Yeah, just for folks listening at home, three of the 21 experts saw positive signs ahead. The others were, as you mentioned, on Dunkelberg's side. One of the things that you mentioned earlier was the jobs. A lot of folks are saying, well, there's really not much further lower we can go with unemployment. Do the economists share that view as well?
Well, obviously, different economists have different views of that, and it is true on the question of the unemployment rate alone. There was a wider divergence here than is typically the case, so if you take all of the answers together, we had answers for or forecasts for the unemployment rate over the next 12 months coming in as low as 3.1% and going as high as 4.5%. So that's basically almost 1.5% breadth in terms of where they see that. So it's scattered, so to speak. But I think if you take it all together, ultimately you say that the unemployment rate probably is getting closer to the low. We don't know where it'll ultimately bottom out. And, you know, the one thing about that, Steve, has been that all along, I guess I should say all along in this case, really meaning about the last couple of years, many people have said, oh, well, you know, we're at full employment. But the reality has been that we've continued to add jobs at a, I would say, a robust pace. But I think that the fact of the matter is that the unemployment rate has continued to go lower than most people have expected, and that includes the forecast that we've gotten from the Federal Reserve, by the way. And therefore, there might be some surprises to the downside with the unemployment rate. One person who is on the lower end of all that is another well-regarded economist, Mark Zandi of Moody's, and he thinks that we can go several percentage, or I should say several tenths of 1% lower than where we are right now. I hope he's right.
Yeah, that would be nice. I know there are probably still some folks out there looking for work that had been on the sidelines. Mark, one of the reasons we love talking with you and your colleagues at Bankrate is you often give us a perspective from the consumer's level about how to better prepare ourselves for what may be ahead. With interest rates going up, people spending on their credit cards, doing a lot of that, not doing a lot of savings, what would you say should be the game plan for consumers over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And that's a great question. And that ultimately is what the question is from our vantage point for both our audience and yours. And obviously we'll have a lot of people in between or among them. And so, you know, we think about the sort of baseline scenarios, the assumptions that seem pretty safe at this point. And that includes the fact that we know that interest rates as managed by the Federal Reserve have continued to go higher. And the Fed has signaled that rates will continue to go higher, basically over the next year, year and a half. And so this has a direct impacts on the cost of borrowing. And so from a very sort of basic perspective, we would say that, first of all, if there ever was a reason to pay down credit card debt and to pay it off, it is now, because as the prime rate goes higher, that automatically lifts pretty much every credit card rate on the face of the planet. And, you know, credit card debt is basically not very productive because, you know, it has now been years since one could deduct that on a tax return. And in other words, you cannot. And so there's not really a great reason to carry that debt over. And there, in fact, there are no good reasons to do that. So we need to pay credit card debt down as the cost of that debt goes higher. There are other variable rates of interest, such as home equity lines of credit, personal loans, obviously adjustable rate mortgages. All of those end up adjusting higher as well over time, and so we need to pay that down.
Yeah, you know what they say, an ounce of prevention, just in case something negative happens in the future.
Absolutely. And you know, certainly for, you know, all of us, whether we are, let's say, well-heeled or have most of our financial goals already attained, the unexpected always occurs, right? Whether it's the breakdown of a car, whether it's some sort of emergency that's more serious, certainly unemployment when recessions occur. I know very few people that say, you know what, I saved too much money. I shouldn't have saved all that money.
Mark, always good chatting with you. Thanks for the information.
Steve, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Mark Hamrick is a senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com. You can find more about the survey there at Bankrate.com. And make sure you follow both on Twitter, @Bankrate, and Mark as well, @Hamrickisms on Twitter.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, looks like we could have a triple-digit increase in the stocks at the opening bell later this morning. Our implied open now for the Dow is up 100 points or more. S&P and NASDAQ futures are higher by about a third to a half a percent, too. Gold is trading lower this morning by $1.50 as silver is higher. Let's get the latest on commodity and agriculture now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We start this week with two trade issues on the front burner. First of all, a report on Saturday that showed China's trade surplus with the United States widened to a record in August. The potentially sensitive surplus hit $31.05 billion in August. That's up from $28.09 billion in July, and it surpassed the previous record set in June. Over the first 8 months of the year, China's surplus with the U.S., its largest export market, has risen nearly 15%. The other trade issue, NAFTA. hasn't been resolved as of yet, and this weekend, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue said Canada must end its low-price milk proteins policy to reach a U.S.-Canadian deal to update the North American Free Trade Agreement. Perdue said in an interview Saturday that Canada had encouraged overproduction, flooded export markets for milk proteins used in cheese and yogurt, hurting U.S. dairy farmers. So the trade talks go on. And this week, it's Grand Island, Nebraska for the Outdoor Farm Show headquarters. Tomorrow at Grand Island, Nebraska, the Husker Harvest Days will get underway. Great trade show, and it focuses a lot on irrigation systems. That'll be operating tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. A couple of other stories here before we leave you this morning. Jack Ma, who founded e-commerce giant Alibaba and helped launch China's online retailing boom, is announcing he will step down as the company's chairman next September. In a letter released by Alibaba, Ma says he will be succeeded by CEO Daniel Zhang, an 11-year veteran of the company. Ma handed over the CEO post to Zhang in 2013 as part of what he said was a long-planned succession. Former British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has compared Prime Minister Theresa May's plan for Brexit to putting the country's constitution in a suicide vest and handing the detonator to the European Union. The attack and Johnson's choice of language widened the divide in the governing Conservative Party over Brexit. Johnson, a strong supporter of Brexit, quit May's government in July after rejecting her proposal for close economic ties with the EU after the UK leaves next year. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, September the 10th. Not a lot on the calendar today. The Federal Reserve releases July's consumer credit data. Turkey, Russia, Japan, and the United Kingdom all report second quarter GDP. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, the UK reports its unemployment rate tomorrow. The Brookings Institution hosts a panel on the financial crisis coming up on Wednesday. Apple announces its new products as well on Wednesday. On Thursday, Kroger will report earnings. U.S. consumer inflation report is due out. Friday, U.S. retail sales and consumer sentiment reports. So after a slow day today, we'll kick off the week with more reports and economic data as we move through each day. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday and the rest of the week, September 10th, 2018.